Please stand. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law. Please be seated.
Thank you. At this time, we're on record in Hamberlin versus Bradford. Matters before the court for oral argument. On behalf of the appellant, Jordan Bradford, Ron Swofford will argue. On behalf of Shad Hamberlin, Christopher Meek will argue. I'd like to welcome the students from the Idaho State University's paralegal program. You don't realize it, but if you graduate and become accomplished paralegals, you'll be better than some lawyers. I hope you all do that. We depend on paralegals so much in this business, so take your studies very seriously, and thank you for it. Anything further by either party? Very well. You may proceed, Mr. Swofford.
And please, the Honorable Chief Justice Burdick and the Honorable members of this court, I appreciate this opportunity and hope that that comment to the paralegals wasn't directed.
No, heavens no. Just in my law firm.
All right. A very quick summary of this case is that a mother miscalculated the periods of sexual access between two young men and executed a signed acknowledgement of paternity identifying the wrong person as the natural father. There's no question in the record that the wrong person identified was the natural father, but the statute involving the verified acknowledgement of paternity nevertheless makes that a legal conclusion that in fact that he is. The issue directly is whether or not the mother's action in signing this acknowledgement was reasonable and prudent under the circumstances, and therefore a reasonable mistake.
Do you think the reasonable prudent standard does apply to the mistake?
I question that. I do question that in my argument. The reason I say that is that, of course, the statute doesn't bring it up. It doesn't refer to 60B. But additionally, it makes it difficult to apply that standard to this individual without looking at the particular circumstances of this individual and her knowledge, her experience, her education, her background, and so forth. So I question whether that is...
So you're saying it's a question of fact that should never be decided without an evidentiary hearing, or that it shouldn't even be part of the analysis?
I think it should be part of the analysis, but I think it should consider the particular social circumstances of the party, and I think it should be determined after an evidentiary hearing and not a ruling on motions without a hearing at all.
And that didn't happen here.
No, it didn't. Here was an oral hearing on March 1st of 2017. The judge asked for a more definite statement. It was provided on March 15th of that year. The judge made a decision on the record on the pleadings on March 30th of 2017. So there was no hearing, no evidentiary hearing permitted.
Was there an offer of proof made as to what kind of evidence you would have proffered concerning the background and circumstances of your client at the time she signed the
parties? I was not, I apologize, I was not involved in the case until a week ago. And Mr. Colbert left private practice and I inherited this. So I was not a party to that, but I understand that all parties argued their positions on March 1st of 2017. The judge simply made a statement in his record at the time, which is a little different. His statement was the court ordered board affidavits from the parties on the facts. Then the court order says the court will then reconsider the respondent's motions, which are not foreclosed at this time. After the amended verified petition was filed, the order just came out on March 30th. So there was no opportunity in between to do that, to my knowledge. Anyway, essentially, those are the critical facts. I want to give you a timeline that I think might be helpful and viewing this as to whether or not the conduct of the petitioner, Ms. Bradford, was reasonable or not, and what standard should apply. She became pregnant approximately December of 2013. That being calculated from the date of the birth of the child on September 24th of 2014, roughly 9 months. The verified acknowledgement of paternity was executed by the mother and her then boyfriend on July 7th of 2015. And as I calculate that, that acknowledgement of paternity was made 19 months after the point in time when she became pregnant, which I think is important to consider with regard to whether or not she was reasonable in making a mistake in determining access between the two men 19 months earlier. Essentially, I won't go through all the details, but the court has most of those to this before the court. The appellant, in filing the motion to rescind the verified acknowledgement of paternity, basically put in her verified petition that there was a material mistake of fact in her calculation of the access date between the two father or the two parties she had actual sexual access with. And understanding that was 19 months earlier. And she miscalculated the months, and she did the calculations with both the boyfriend she was living with at the time. And then about a year later, she met again with Mr. Edwards, and with that individual who's the natural father, he showed her the calculations. They went back again, and she became concerned that she had made a mistake and she had committed a
So just to be clear then, is the mistake in this case that her math was bad, or is the mistake in this case that she didn't realize that she had sex with two men contemporaneously?
It was the math. It was the math.
But if she had sex with two men contemporaneously to each other, why would the math matter?
Well, it was because she had relations with Mr. Edwards in November and December, but she had forgotten some of that. And she began a new relationship with Mr. Edwards, Mr. Chamberlain, right after that. And she had just actually forgotten about the sexual access before Mr. Chamberlain and just miscalculated. She just
remembered. Your answer to my question sounds like it's not that she couldn't do the math and subtract 9 months from September. It sounds like she just didn't remember who she was having sex with at what period of time.
She forgot. She forgot that she was having sex with him in December. And that's really about the malice, too.
Do you think that's a difference between a mistake in math and a mistake about your intimate relationships?
Well, it's just... She forgot she had had sexual intercourse with him at all in December. That's the first thing. It was an on-and-off relationship. She put in her affidavit, or verified petition amended, that it was an on-and-off relationship with Mr. Edwards' natural father, and she had forgotten the period of time they were together, knowing that it was 19 months earlier when she became pregnant. And she had been with Mr. Chamberlain for several months as of April of 2017 when she learned she was pregnant, or I'm sorry, 14 when she was pregnant. So she assumed that she'd been with him for about 4 months, and they did some calculations together. She made the assumption that he was the father, and she felt comfortable with that at the time. She had simply forgotten the dates and forgotten that because of the on-and-off relationship, she had forgotten the period of access with Mr. Edwards, the natural father. And Mr. Edwards refreshed her memory in the fall of 2016, and went back with her and talked with her about these dates, and that's when she began to be suspicious that she may have made a mistake. There was some evidentiary testing done, some paternity testing done in November of 2016, and a test afterward which conclusively established that Mr. Chamberlain was not the natural father, but in fact, Mr. Edwards was a natural father. Under those circumstances, the question is whether she behaved reasonably, and under what standard should be applied to that? And I can only indicate that, to me, it's the question that I would submit to the court is, should she be held to the standard of a 22-year-old young lady who with a high school education, limited life experiences, limited work experiences, or should she be compared with a theoretical senior at Stanford who's the same age and with the memories and the experiences that have occurred? And it's hard for me to give that, to compute that myself sometimes. I was a public defender. Another attorney and I started that system at Bonneville County in the late 70s, and I met a lot of people from very difficult backgrounds, limited education, limited memories, limited abilities, and yet they were held to the same standard. And there are times when I walked out of the courtroom thinking, there before the grace of God go I. And so it's difficult for me to apply the reasonable person standard, reasonable man standard, and apply that across the board without reference or deference to her circumstances and having the right to put on evidence as to her particular circumstances or whether she should be held to a theoretical legal standard.
So, in other words, you're suggesting that we shouldn't apply an objective standard, which is what the reasonable person standard is, and we should apply a subjective standard, which looks at each case, looks at the age of the person, their education, their background, their sophistication, in determining whether or not it was reasonable for them to sign a VAP?
Well, I understand that's difficult. It's easier to apply the historical standard because it's simple.
Well, and particularly when you have children involved who now, she's almost 5 years old in this case, certainly I recognize that the case law points us to solely on what her circumstances are, but reasonableness also needs to take into account the finality issue that's talked about in Justice Horton's opinion about finality is pretty important in these circumstances.
It is, and it's also important to weigh the rights of the natural father. This statute is peculiar in that it allows the mother to determine who the father is in the law, and him decide to and completely omit the natural father in any way, shape, or form. That
can we consider the natural father's rights where he's not part of this equation? He's not here.
He did file an affidavit in this action and ask for a hearing also and paternity testing to establish that he was the father. So he involved himself by way of an affidavit. And I might mention the statute does not prevent anyone but the parties to seek to set aside this acknowledgement of paternity. It says the parties can. No one else. So the statute prohibits that.
Right, but I guess I felt you maybe incorrectly going down the path of saying, you know, this statute should be invalid or something akin to it because it allows the mother to, in essence, terminate the rights of the biological father.
Well, I think the court has an inherent power to look at the constitutionality of a statute under due process and equal protection. I understand that that's not the direct issue before the court has at times, at least in my understanding, has found alternate grounds for granting relief to parties.
But you haven't alleged that.
No, we did not, Your Honor.
Is there any evidence the biological father listed himself on a putative father registry?
I don't know that, Your Honor. I don't know that. I didn't see it in the record when I went over this yesterday and prepared for this, but I didn't see I don't see anything in the record about it at all. So I don't have that knowledge.
Well, and would your client have standing to raise the biological father's constitutional rights? And what I'm referring to specifically is, I remember in January of 17, a decision that we issued all about involved a lesbian couple who conceived a child through in vitro fertilization, and we said that the non-biological putative parent had no rights to, no standing to allege the interests of the child.
That's a very good question, and I had I prepared the brief, I might have included more information on that. And I apologize for that, but I'm only suggesting that if the court may wish to consider whether or not the natural father, whether that statute is constitutional, as it happens. It treats the natural father giving him no rights at all, and him learning a year later and not having the right to even contest it under the statute. He cannot. It says the parties can. So he's without a remedy in any way, and by the statute, he's without a remedy in any way, shape, or form. He joined in this by filing an affidavit and asked for that relief, but that's simply under the way the proceedings went. There was no evidentiary hearing and no opportunities beyond that. But essentially, that is a concern of mine, let's put it that way. And looking at his circumstances as the natural father and his rights, basically she gave up his right to be a father to this child for the rest of his life. By signing a document, whether or not her conduct was reasonable or not reasonable, I don't know that anyone should have the power to sign over someone else's rights for the rest of their life to be a parent to a child. So it's just an odd, it's, reading the statute is very odd to me and very difficult to reconcile. So I leave that to the court. But essentially, I've looked and studied a little bit about this reasonable person standard, and I find it difficult to apply that standard under the circumstances simply because here's how it's applied in my frame of mind as of what I've seen in my practice. If we're asking a judge or a jury member to decide whether the conduct of a person was reasonable, to me that's the application of one's mind. In other words, I'm asked that, I think, okay, I have got all the facts now, got them all clear to me, even though they may not have been that clear to the parties, but I've got them all. And what I have done the same thing under those circumstances. Well, if I decide I'm a reasonable person, if I decide that I would not have done that, then I've already determined that was not reasonable. And that seems to be, how do we can't even define, I don't think I can, maybe the court can, but I can't define this reasonable proof man standard. I've looked and tried this. It's a nebulous concept to begin with. And I can't define it in any way, shape, or form. It looks like it's like they used to say about pornography. I can't define it, but I don't want to see it. And it's like this sort of situation that it's my concept of what's reasonable. And we're not weighing, and the person that does that does not weigh in the circumstances of anybody else except himself.
But don't we routinely on a daily basis have juries and judges throughout this state and throughout our nation making decisions about what's reasonable or not? Isn't that one of the pillars of our legal system, is that we apply objective standards to certain types of behavior?
We have done that. I'm not sure if they're fair to apply it in all cases. I'm not asking to apply that in all criminal cases or all negligence cases or other kinds of cases, but in this particular circumstance, consider the gravity of what she's doing when she signs that acknowledgement and the fact that there's no notice to the natural parent, and the fact that she's making determination based on her knowledge and her memory and her recollection of events 19 months earlier, that perhaps that standard should be modified in some way to consider those aspects of her social status and her social experiences, to consider what was reasonable for her under the circumstances. Otherwise, we do compare her with any one of us in the same situation.
This is a hard question to answer. I don't want you to say anything you're uncomfortable saying here, counsel, but when I read briefs and such in cases like this, I see what the attorneys think the case is about, and it doesn't always tell me what the parties think the case is about. Help me understand from your client's perspective, what is she hoping to achieve in this case?
Okay, that's a very good question. I do know that, and I've thought about that. That's an important consideration to me. Basically, she feels very badly that she signed this agreement without stopping thinking, talking to him, doing some calculations, and talking to both people she had access with to make sure she was right. She just assumed it, went by her memory, and did it. And then she realizes that she's now depriving the natural father of a lifetime of opportunities to share with his own child. And it bothers her conscience terribly. That really is her point.
Could an inference be drawn from the record that she doesn't want the appellant, in, excuse me, the respondent in this case, to have visitation rights, and that's why she's bringing this action?
You know, I don't. I've not seen that anywhere, and I don't know that, and I would not recommend that under any circumstance. If there were a resolution, I would recommend that this man have rights and have visitation and share in that child too. It's not fair. It's not fair to either father or either parent, either the putative or their natural father. It's not fair. But I don't like the other shutting him out either. That's not fair either. So if I had a way to do it, that's what I would do. And I think maybe there's a way under the statutes to, if there's a substantial relationship, maybe there's a way under the statutes on custody and visitation that he can make that claim of having some right under these circumstances. I've not tested that, but I would agree with you that...
Was there any evidence at all of duress that the putative father talked her into this? We're going to be soulmates forever, and if you don't do this, I'm going to leave. And any facts of that nature?
Just the part that she put in her verified petition, that they had a conversation, they looked at this, they talked about when they started having sexual access, and both concluded that it was his child.
Okay.
That's all she could really say. I don't think it was duress. It was a mutual decision the two of them made based on what they recalled.
Very good.
With that, I'll end at this point. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. On behalf of the respondent.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Burdick, Justice Stegner, Justice Brody, Justice Bevin, Justice Moore. My name is Christopher Meek. I represent the respondent, Chad Hammerlin. I'd also like to recognize my esteemed colleague, Ronald Swofford, and my client, who's here in the courtroom and in the ISU paralegal program, court staff. This appeal, Justices, is about the definition of mistake. Like Yogi Berra, at least to you, Justice Burdick, it must feel somewhat like deja vu all over again hearing this case because of its similarity to Gordon v. Hedrick. It was a 2015
case. You presuppose I can remember anything.
Then it's deja vu all over
again. Touché.
And there's really not much difference in the basic facts of the cases, honestly. When you look at them, Ms. Hedrick in the Hedrick case stated on page 607 of the decision, quote, immediately prior to commencing my relationship with Gordon, I was intimate with another male friend of mine. I made Gordon aware of this fact. Then you look at this case, the record, page 205, specifically paragraph 3, where Ms. Bradford essentially acknowledges the same, although it's implicit in her statements, when she says, Shad, quote, and I talked about the possible timing of the pregnancy and decided that he had to be the biological father of the minor child at issue herein. I never contacted Matthew Edwards about the pregnancy because I believed that respondent and I had calculated the conception date at a time when I had sexual relationships with Shad.
And how can that be anything about a material mistake?
Excuse me?
How can that be anything but a material mistake?
It's a great question. And the reason why it's a great question is because it assumes that the answer of mistake assumes that she did not know of other alternatives at the time. I will propose to the court that there are really two different types of mistake that are being proposed to you, one by the appellant and one by my client. And the one by the appellant is a contractual mistake. It's stated in the briefing, they ask for a contractual definition of mistake, specifically it's arguing that that the mistake is essentially an error. But if you look, Your Honors, at what the statute 7-1106 stands for, it's not a contract statute. It's a statute about a judgment. A voluntary acknowledgement of paternity is essentially a stipulated judgment. And so when you look at it that way, we can't interpret a voluntary acknowledgement of paternity as a contract to be determined under contract principles.
But it's not signed by either gentleman. Right? It's all unilateral on the part of the woman.
Correct. Well, all the more reason why it's a stipulation. My client would have ostensibly the ability to argue that he doesn't want to have parental authorities because he's not the biological father. It's fraudulently stated he's not, or it's a mistake on her part, whatever that would be. But he doesn't assert that in this case at all. So he would still have the right to protect himself. Just like, to answer the questions that were asked earlier, I think it was yours, question, Justice Mueller, the question about whether or not the biological father had rights in this situation and were they ignored. Maybe I'm addressing the wrong justice. But if you look at that issue, in order to be involved in a case like this, it's possible that the biological father could have asserted his rights. He could have intervened. He didn't do so. There's nothing in the record to show that he did so.
Nothing to suggest he had notice.
He filed an affidavit.
No, I'm talking about before.
Before when?
When the voluntary acknowledgement of paternity is signed.
Oh, certainly. But that's true for every father who has sex with a female and decides, doesn't follow up with that female, doesn't maintain a relationship, and that female, this goes to the point that I was making, that female can then file, if the father has not filed on the putative father registry and has not filed a petition for to protect his paternal rights under the paternal rights codes of the state of Idaho, mom then can file a petition for adoption, and that father has absolutely no rights to any information about any adoption or any further custody litigation or anything. That's the laws of the state. And so if that's the case, is that really different than a mother signing a voluntary acknowledgement of paternity, as signing a father rights without ever notifying that father, the biological father? It's no different. She's essentially picked the dad, she put it on the birth certificate, the father didn't assert his rights in this case, and we're here where we're here today because the record stands. Didn't assert that right, and my client is the legal father of the child, unless a mistake is found.
Why do you think this statute was passed? For the bookkeeping of the Department of Health and Welfare and vital statistics, or to do justice as concerns biological and putative parents?
You know, that's a great question, and certainly I can give you my opinion. I can
Please
tell
do.
You I have
that's
not
what I asked
done...
for.
The historic history on it, but I think it's for finality. Children need a stable relationship. They need somebody who's been involved in their life from day one. And if the mother, in an on and off relationship, picks who that father is and identifies that individual as being the father who cares and loves for their child, that's why it's there. And that's why it's as final as it states it is, because this is not something that people should take lightly. It's not something that should be just a fly-by-night thing I decide to do. It's rather something that's very serious, as it states in the actual document that is signed. I am saying, I'm verifying this person here, whether I've checked into it or not, I'm verifying this person's the biological father of this child. And that goes straight to the issue of reasonableness. And segueing into that, when we're talking about a reasonable person standard, the question really is that what applies? And I would propose that Rule 60B, because it is looking at setting aside judgments, is really a good starting point for this court to look at when it examines what rule should apply. Now, I know there's differences between Rule 60B and the actual statutory language, because you have other language or other venues that could set aside a judgment that are different between the two.
But there's usually a clash between people who are represented and have an interest in the disposition of the case and are therefore impacted by the judgment, and we don't have that here, do we?
You mean vis-a-vis the biological father?
Yes.
Certainly. But again, Your Honor, I go to whether or not that individual is somebody we have to be concerned about in this case.
Should he be an indispensable party?
No. For the reasons I've stated before. When I file a petition for adoption with an unlisted father, I don't list the father and the biological father or the potential biological fathers or any putative fathers in the petition unless they have done two things. One, file on the putative father registry, and two, file the petition for custody to protect and perfect their right to ask for custody. That's the status of the statutes. Fathers in Idaho, frankly, across the nation, and when I say fathers, I say that loosely. Unless there's lots of other more pejorative terms I suppose I could use for that. But basically what I'm saying is fathers who are uninterested in the life of a child without actively trying to protect their rights as a father. And it's their burden, pursuant to those paternity rights statutes, clearly in the policy statements in the early parts of those statutes, it very clearly says that it's the father's responsibility to protect their own rights. So in this instance, where father, biological father, does nothing, I do not believe that he is an indispensable party. He had to assert those rights, and he didn't do so.
And that reflects a policy decision made by the legislature in adopting the putative father registry? Is that the intent of that legislation?
I would say that's absolutely true, because the policy is clearly stated in the language of the statute as the putative fathers. If they don't assert their rights, they lose them, which is property 101, right? That's what, and I know that children are property, but certainly it's a legal principle that goes back to time immemorial. That's true. So when the court looks at the Hedrick decision, you'll see that the court identifies the statutory language of fraud, duress, or material mistake. And then you look at how the Gordon court basically parsed it out that it's not a mutual mistake, which was the issue really in Gordon. But the issue in this case, as in the Gordon case, was that mistake really is the heart of the decision. And in that case, the district court, and of course this court, affirmed the decision of the magistrate that it's not a mistake, essentially, to boil it down. It's not a mistake if you have reason to know, if you know there's somebody out there who's a potential father, and you rule them out by signing a voluntary acknowledgement of paternity, you've made a decision. A conscious decision in the face of alternatives cannot be a mistake.
So what would be a mistake?
That's a great question. So here's, and I struggle with this one, but for example, because it's hard to think of circumstances, but here's a couple that I've thought of that maybe may apply. Let's assume that you're a married woman. You crawl into bed, you assume the person you're sleeping with is your husband, but it's not. Now maybe you're partially inebriated, I don't know. It's hard to think of that specific fact, right? But there's certainly a potential out there that there's a fact, and you believe that that person is the father because you are in the absence of an alternative. You don't know anything else other than that until it's presented to you later on, after you've signed or after you've been in a situation where maybe it's your boyfriend. Maybe that's a better example. That you thought it was your boyfriend, but it's not, until you're presented with facts later on down the road that you had no knowledge of, because you didn't face that alternative choice that it could have been somebody else, to rule that out as a reasonable person would do.
But isn't that kind of a ridiculous example?
Sure.
And the reason I ask is because, I mean, is that just, does that lead to a ridiculous interpretation of the statute?
Well, let me give another one.
Okay.
If I may. Yeah. How about a person who is raped?
Okay.
And a man, they don't know who the individual is per se, but that man is that man's convicted. A person is convicted of rape, wrongfully convicted, and the mother assumes that that person is in fact the father. And so because of that, she determines that she wants, even though she's been raped, it's a wrongful act, that she wants this child to know their father, and agrees that he's the dad. Not that, I mean, yeah, it's a little crazy and far-fetched, so to speak, but it's also possible that that could happen. And if that happens, then she learns later, after the conviction is overturned, that this person is not the father, would that not be a mistake of fact that the court should look at to determine that somebody else should be listed on the birth certificate rather than the individual she identified, thinking it was the baby's father? And in that circumstance, I think that's why the mistake law is there. Certainly doesn't apply easily in my mind in a situation where a mother knows the potential of two different individuals and consciously chooses to pick one, which we have in this case.
Let's address that. Was it a conscious choice, or was a choice made out of a misunderstanding of human biology, or just naivete?
Well, I want the court to look specifically at the timeline of the case. And I know this is not a direct answer to your question. It partially answers a question I think you asked earlier. But look at the timeline of the case and how this plays out. We filed a petition in October of 2017 asking the court to give my client some custodial rights because he's broken up with Ms. Bradford and he wants to spend some time with his child and he can't. It isn't until January that we get the first motion to rescind the voluntary acknowledgement of paternity when Ms. Bradford admits in an affidavit that at that point in time, she is now engaging in communication with the biological father. And at that point in time, she now remembers that she had sexual access to him before.
Well, given that statement, then I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Swofford. What is this case really about from the client's perspective?
Well, I think that inference can be made and was made, although not expressly, by the magistrate court and potentially the district court. Because of the language, when you look at what she says in her affidavit, you don't sit down to determine who the father is with the person that you're with if you are in the absence of information that it could potentially be somebody else. For example, four kids, I married. I didn't sit down with my wife and say, well, was it me? Should my name go on the voluntary acknowledgement of paternity or not? I mean, it wasn't a conversation we had. Why? Because it was just us. And there was no doubt that, you know, in our minds, we'd have to have that conversation unless I was defrauded, which...
Yeah, we don't need to make any confessions here today.
My wife's a wonderful, amazing woman. Well, I'm lucky to have her.
Yeah, I'm not worried about your wife.
So
does this type of document ever get used by couples perhaps as a shortcut to adoption? And what I mean is... You know, maybe a woman comes into a marriage with a child where no father's been listed on the birth certificate, and she lists her new spouse or even a boyfriend for that matter as the child's father. That is, knowing that in fact the person is not the biological father.
You know, I hadn't thought about that, but I would assume that it does. Why wouldn't it? Because the very language of the document, I think, speaks to what its purpose is. It's a voluntary acknowledgement of paternity. It doesn't say voluntary acknowledgement that this person, although it is in the language, this person is absolutely the biological father. It serves an administrative and a legal purpose. It doesn't say, I know for certain this person is the biological father based on scientific evidence. The acknowledgement says, I acknowledge that this person is the biological father. And so, to me, that although it may be a way around that rule of adoption.
I'm just thinking of a poor man's adoption. You know, I mean, it's expensive, it's time consuming, and
well, on the other hand, I think adoptions in the context of adoption, when nobody's on the birth certificate administratively, you don't have to do that. You need this process to get there. So certainly that would apply. So asking questions again about the reasonable person, and these are rhetorical questions. Why didn't she speak to this other individual at the time? If she had any doubt in her mind or was trying to figure out a timeline, why didn't she do that? Would a reasonable person not talk to both individuals to try and ferret that out? Certainly she knew she could do a paternity test because she did one after the fact, after my client filed this petition. She could have asked for that. A reasonable person would ferret out that option and make sure that the decision was made prudently, carefully, not just haphazardly, unless there was an intent to specifically have my client be the father. Look at and I guess to move on a bit, in my mind, Ms. Bradford essentially is asking this court to second guess and reweigh the evidence of the trial court and the district court.
Well, there was no evidence taken other than affidavits, was there?
That's evidence.
I understand that, but there's no deference owed to somebody who doesn't hear witnesses testify, is there?
Well, although that may be the case, I'm not sure that the case law parses out, I'm happy to be corrected. I'm not sure the case law parses out that this court then reviews those factual determinations set forth in affidavits de novo. Certainly in summary judgment proceedings, I don't know if we do that. Maybe we do. Maybe you do. But it seems to me that if that's the case, then the magistrate court weighed the evidence, made its decision.
But isn't it a better process to have an evidentiary hearing where the magistrate can hear the witnesses and understand what the motivation is?
It could be, but the procedural posture of this case didn't present itself that way. Recall that it was Ms. Bradford who filed the motion to rescind the voluntary acknowledgement of paternity. She's the one who filed the affidavit to present the facts that the court would require or need in order to make a determination about whether the VAP would stand or whether it should be rescinded. So I think the burden was on her at that point to produce by clear and convincing evidence, as is the standard set forth in the case law, that the VAP should be rescinded, and she didn't meet that burden.
Well, no, not that the VAP should be rescinded, but that the VAP was as a result of duress, fraud, or material mistake of fact.
As the grounds for rescission.
Right, right. And that's material mistake of fact, again, I go back to what Justice, good old Justice, him, yeah. Like I said, there we go, Stegner. Justice Stegner said, and that is there anything more material than who I had sex with and who is in fact the biological father as a result? So is a date of sexual activity a material mistake of fact? I guess is the question. In this case, the date of sexual activity, is that a mistake of fact?
A recollection of sexual activity? Well, it is.
Mistake of fact as to the date I had sexual activity.
It is, Your Honor, if you acknowledge that definition of mistake is just a simple act or omission. But when you look at the definition used
by... Well, material mistake.
Certainly, because...
And that's the question of Justice Stegner. Is there anything more material in this analysis than this issue?
Certainly it's material.
Okay.
Certainly it's
and
that.
That's
the question
what the,
is a material mistake. And when you look at the definition of mistake proposed to you by the appellant, it's an inadvertent act or omission. Inadvertent. There's nothing inadvertent about what Ms. Bradford did here.
Well, she made a decision that this was the day of sexual activity that led to a child's birth, and she made the material mistake. Now, I think what you're trying to get us to do is go to the issue of credibility. Why did she make that decision originally?
Well, in part, but I'd also say, is it inadvertent if it's a decision? An inadvertent act or omission. In other words, I didn't consciously do this. Because why? Why would you not consciously do this? Because you were unaware of other alternatives. But look at her affidavit. That's not what she says. She says, I had to decide whether or not Mr. Hammerlin was the father or not, based on the fact that I knew I had sexual access with another man on or about the same time. I didn't talk to that other man at the time. She says because she didn't think it was the correct date, but to me, she knew or should have known that he could potentially be the father. And to me, it also seems, maybe as to go to the credibility part of it, Justice, it's if you look at the timing of when she says, memories to me don't work the way she's suggesting they work. I have the child, and then 5 months later when I'm in a relationship with Mr. Hammerlin, now all of a sudden I'm saying he's the dad, but somehow now, a year and a half later, or whenever
and
it is,
that's
now,
what I mean by credibility.
I can remember
right.
That now I had sex with this guy because I forgot the fact that I had sex with him.
So you're suggesting this isn't a mistake, this is buyer's remorse, and she's trying to capitalize on the mistake.
Yes, that's exactly what she's doing. She's trying to use the law as a weapon against Mr. Hammerlin to remove him from the life of this child whom he's loved and cared for, changed diapers of and everything else because he was with her during that entire time that she was young, that the child was young. And now the child is, what, 5 years old? And what she's suggesting that this court do is remove him entirely from the life of the child because, as we all know, we can't sage what a party will do after a court decision is done. It's their right to do it. And if Mr. Hammerlin, if the voluntary acknowledgement of paternity does not apply, it's tantamount to terminating his parental right. And if a person doesn't have parental rights, they have no ability to force themselves into the life of a child because it's a constitutional right of a parent to raise a child. they can make decisions without who that person is around.
Can you develop just a little more? I think you started to get there and then taken elsewhere, but in terms of how we get to Rule 60, when we're applying statutory language and nowhere speaks to that, I know this court utilized Rule 60 in terms of, I think, the clear and convincing evidence standard, but why do we go there in this analysis rather than just what the words mean on the page by the legislature?
Thanks, Justice Bevin. The reason why I think we get there is because we are talking about a judgment. A BAP is a judgment. And so the only law that we have that determines what a mistake is set forth in the Rule 60B language of mistake. So to me, it seems like a very simple bridge to cross for this court to say 60B case law applies because mistake is mistake. The word is the same. All we're doing is determining what a mistake would mean. And under that case law and under that rule, it says that a mistake is a person who is claiming mistake has a responsibility to act as a reasonably prudent person would do in protecting their rights or protecting the right to claim mistake. They have to act diligently. So certainly there's a time element to that. You saw the district court overturn Judge Riddock in his magistrate court decision regarding that issue. But as to the definition of mistake, he applies a reasonably prudent person standard.
So that's the real problem with this case, that we didn't have a decision by a fact finder that had reviewed all the facts. If we had had a decision based upon an evidentiary hearing in which we learned more about the character and background of all of the parties, perhaps judgment about their relative credibility, and we had the benefit of all that with the high deference we show to the fact finder, wouldn't that have made this a lot easier case for us to decide? And likely one that wouldn't be forcing us to make some really hard choices here? I'm just wondering about the implications of deciding these cases on the pleadings rather than actually having an evidentiary hearing.
It's a good question. I think that any time that we have the benefit of additional information, we have the ability to make better decisions.
Should the child be represented in the action through a guardian ad litem?
Wow. I hadn't thought about that. Certainly that would... I am never adverse unless there are allegations of alienation or some other twisted concept of how a child's mind is messed with, and those always come out in the facts in a custody case. But otherwise, I think it's beneficial for a child to have a voice in court because their perspective is unique to them, which is really what the case is about. It seems odd to me in custody cases that we sit in a court and fight over somebody who is a human being and thinks on their own, yet rarely has the ability to say what they think needs to happen because it's hearsay. So how do we get that in? Well, through a guardian ad litem or an attorney to represent the child if they have capacity to direct the attorney.
And I guess the only problem I have with that is the statement from Gordon where we said it wasn't a mutual mistake question, it's solely a unilateral mistake on the part of the mother. It's really, why are we looking at what the child wants or what dad wants or what putative dad, what did mom think and did she make a mistake, right? Isn't that kind of what we said in court?
That's exactly, Your Honor, the situation. That's the law.
I mean, at this point, we're 5 years down the road. What's to say another case couldn't come along where it's 10 or 15 years, this child's been raised by a dad that's not his bio dad, and mom finds out, and there's a divorce, and she's mad, and so she wants to rescind on the basis I made a mistake 15 years ago.
Which goes...
This holding would apply to those cases.
Which exactly goes to the policy behind the decision, or I guess I should say the force that comes from this decision. If this court decides that my client does not have the right to the voluntary acknowledgement of paternity based on mistake under Rule 60B was inappropriate, the district court should be turned around, and that a mistake can be as simple thing as I didn't rule out other individuals, but I determined the date was wrong, and therefore that's a mistake, and I get to set aside a voluntary acknowledgement of paternity. What's to stop the floodgate? What is to stop every single biological mother who is in an unmarried relationship with a person who they have deemed to be the father, who's been involved in the life of the child, to come to court and say, I messed this up. He's not the dad. it doesn't matter whether or not we add in all the other information about what's happened and who, how good of a person they are or what the involvement of the life of the child is, because as Justice Bevin just acknowledged, the statute doesn't say that. The statute doesn't ask this court to look at all those aspects. The statute simply asks the court to determine whether or not there's a mistake. And if you can determine that that's a mistake because they mistook who the person was that they slept with, and that's not the dad, now all of a sudden that biological father has no, or that, sorry, that, that father who's listed as the biological father on a voluntary acknowledgement of paternity, his rights are toast. And now biological mother gets to determine who she wants involved in that child's life unilaterally by making that sole claim. So a mother who has multiple sexual relationships with others, yet determines who the father is, knowing that she's had multiple sexual relationships, can now undo that relationship when the relationship sours with the person she has identified.
One of the problems we have, the legislature makes substantive law, we make procedural law. So is this case the mechanism whereby we say, yes, that's what the statute says, that you can overturn a VAP, but here's going to be the procedure we're going to use, and as in all things with minor children, we're going to look to the best interests of the child in addition to whatever the statutory overlay is, and include a procedure that includes the GAL as well as an actual hearing, so we can determine credibility as to whether it was a mistake of fact or as indicated, buyer's remorse or whatever else you want to call it.
Your Honor,
could that be done?
As much as I would love to answer you that you could do that, I think the struggle is based on the prior arguments I've heard today. The legislature did not specifically authorize the court to do that. It doesn't say that you're supposed to look at all those other aspects. It gives you very strict parameters as to whether or not the VAP should
but be considered. But we can put together a procedure that to find out what that parameter is, seems to me.
To determine whether a mistake
has taken place as a finding of fact.
I guess I'm having a hard time seeing how that would work. Based solely on the language of mistake, how could you then infuse the child into life to make a determination of mistake? Arguably, the mistake was done prior to the child even being born.
Well, it's either that or this is a horribly defective statute.
Well, and that's possible, but I also think that the court has the ability to at least interpret statutory language.
Well, material mistake of fact. What else could there be than this person isn't the father because of sexual access? What other mistake of fact could there be?
Well, in the language of the statute. I don't know. That's
material mistake of fact. What is it other than sexual act creating the child?
I don't know.
I don't either. I mean,
but certainly in understanding that language of mistake, how greatly it affects a child's life is troubling. And I agree with Your Honor about that. I don't know how you don't damage the life of a child when you allow these in cases where the mistake is not. As clear
in areas where the legislature has not acted, do we have plenary power to act?
I don't know the answer to that, but I certainly think that those...
I would answer yes, but maybe they would disagree.
Well, maybe all the people who believe in judicial activism might disagree.
We can talk about that. I have a speech that's entitled, "I'm a Judicial Activist and Damn Proud of It." Thank you, sir. How much time does the appellant have?
10 minutes,
sir.
I won't take anywhere near that.
I've had cases with you, sir.
I'm just going to summarize a couple of things. There's a few things I disagree with, but that are important. Basically, I just remind the court that voluntary acknowledgement of paternity was something she signed 19 months after her pregnancy, asking her to go back in time to make that computation that long. I don't know how many young people who are sexually active can remember the dates of sexual access 19 months earlier.
I think that's a human mistake, actually. The next thing is that this is not only the right of the father, but it's the right of the child. They both fundamental rights. Each of them have a right to the father to parent the child, and the child to have this natural father association. The statute seems to want to very easily remove both of those without any due process or equal protection arguments, giving them those rights. A termination. Terminations can be set aside if they're fraudulent or incorrect. Adoptions and terminations have been set aside under the right circumstances. This statute doesn't give anybody a right to challenge it except parties, which means the natural father has no right to challenge it.
Well, but Mr. Meeks points out the putative father registry, saying if you want to protect your rights, that's your mechanism.
I don't see any evidence in the record that that was ever checked or ever is. I can't find anything in the record even to make any reference to that of any kind in my review of all the decisions and the arguments and so forth. So,
well, that's likely because the actual biological father didn't intervene, even though he was aware of the case and filed an affidavit.
He intervened once he found out. He intervened. They had a discussion in the fall of 2016. He had paternity tests in November of 2016. She filed it when the test showed positively that he was the father and not the respondent. Then she filed in January. He filed affidavits and supported that, and then the court cited it by the basis of pleadings.
Right, but in the legal sense of the term intervention, he has not become a party in this case. He's only a witness.
No, he is not allowed to by the statute. The statute doesn't give him the right.
Well, why didn't he file a separate action then?
Well, that's a good question, except I can only indicate from what I understand, a lot of 22-year-olds, 23-year-olds don't have the money to challenge statutes and take it to the Supreme Court.
The law makes 18-year-olds adults. I'm just wondering if we want to extend that to 22-year-olds and 23-year-olds. There comes a time when we have to treat adults as adults.
And
if they are engaged in reckless behavior, the consequences of that are based upon their choices.
Now, I would only indicate that the legal aspects of being an adult are not necessarily correspondent with the actual aspects of being an adult. Some people at 22 are very immature, and some people at 40 are very immature. So I can't deny that, but that's just the way life is. But essentially, there are no procedural protocols. And lastly, there's no evidence in the record to suggest in any way that this was other than a material mistake of fact under these circumstances. So to argue it was intentional or something of that nature, there was no evidence before the court to suggest it's not a material mistake of fact, and there's nothing in the statute that requires anything more to be considered other than that premise. Thank you.
Thank you. This matter is under advisement. We'll render decisions.
Please stand.